Well, good evening and a very warm welcome everybody to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. After a couple more tunes, we're going to spend this evening's show looking at a pair of singularly unorthodox theories concerning the nature of the mind and consciousness and the nature of the universe in which those minds and consciousnesses exist. We'll be talking about Carl Pribram, who's a researcher and neurosurgeon, and a friend of the Zen Buddhist teacher Alan Watts, whose material I know many of you are familiar with. Pribram proposes in a nutshell that our brains mathematically construct concrete reality by interpreting frequencies from another dimension, a realm of meaningful patterned primary reality that transcends time and space. The brain, he says, is a hologram interpreting a holographic universe. David Bohm, as a theoretical physicist, was an associate of Einstein and a close friend of Krishnamurti, so he's got mystical connections as well. Bohm stated that primary physical laws cannot be discovered by a science that attempts to break the world into its parts. And he proposed that the hologram is a starting point for a new description of reality, which he calls the unfolded order. Classical reality, Bohm says, has focused on secondary manifestations, the unfolded aspect of things, not their source. These appearances are abstracted from an intangible, invisible flux that is not comprised of its parts. It is an inseparable interconnectedness. Once Bohm and Pribram's theories came together, they really seemed to hit it off. And there's many reasons for talking about this, really. One of them is that actually being aware of this material, according to these guys, understanding it, can make a difference to the way the world itself manifests around us. The other is that it's been of interest to me for many years. I've suspected for some time, even before I came across Einstein's statement that the solution cannot really be solved from the level of the problem. It's always been my suspicion that there are other layers to the problems that we're facing in everyday life. And these two characters make a really nice interface between the actual reality that we experience, the administrative reality, and the actual physical reality that we deal with every day. And really some quite outrageous physics and outrageous ideas. But we'll get onto that in 5 or 10 minutes or so whilst to get myself together. And a couple more tunes, and then I will be back with you. If all's going well, the computer, I must admit, is particularly crotchety tonight. It's proven to be very slow to obey my commands, so if at any point I disappear, don't adjust the dial, I will be back. Dr. Rock live on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. Tonight, endeavouring to explore on the radio the holographic paradigm and certain other paradoxes associated with it. As I mentioned, one of the characters we're going to be looking at, whose work we're going to be looking at, is Carl Pribram, whose theory of the holographic brain has not been seriously challenged, been watching it for a long time, and in fact, consciousness research repeatedly tends to back up and add detail to his claims that were now made quite some time ago. There's an impressive body of research now in many laboratories that's demonstrated that our brain structures see, hear, taste, smell, and touch by using sophisticated mathematical analysis of temporal and spatial frequencies. And an eerie property both of the hologram and the brain is the distribution of information throughout the system. Each fragment is encoded to produce the information of the whole. And this, of course, is very different from the orthodox view, which tends to insist that everything is basically separate from everything else. These two men, Carl Pribram and David Bohm, are arguing that it is exactly the other way round. Now, David Bohm's not a particularly electric performer on the internet. He's got a lot of interesting stuff to say, but none of it actually covers with any density the sort of material we're going to be looking at tonight. In fact, it's taken a couple of weeks or so of trawling through various documents, papers, and books that I've got to kind of condense this stuff into material that I think will be well acceptable, understandable, and gettable across, if you like, within 3 hours or so. The basic papers I used, one of them was called A New Perspective on Reality from the special updated issue of the Brain Mind Bulletin, itself a pretty mind-boggling publication. An essay called Carl Pribram's Changing Reality by a lady called Marilyn Ferguson, and a conversation with David Bohm, which was conducted by René Weber, who is himself a spectacular interviewer, especially when put in the same room as minds like the ones we're going to be thinking about tonight. And that was called The Enfolding Unfolding Universe. All three of those are available in a book, which I got several years ago and have lost a couple of times and been forced to go out and get again. But it's called The Holographic Paradigm and Other Paradoxes. It's edited by another really man with another really fine mind, a character called Ken Wilber, who I'm sure at some point will be appearing on the Dr. Rock show in one form or another. It was published by Shambhala, this book, in 1982. The seeds for this show really formed when I was looking into all of that stuff about Huxley and Darwin and the Esalen Institute. And one of the major myths or stories that this undermined was the connection between quantum mechanical theory, modern physical theory, such as it is, and the extension of the human mind or whatever. And it was said that basically it had been quantum mechanics had been misinterpreted, misrepresented, such that many people were being poorly informed about its actual connections with the human entity, with the mind, with consciousness. It raised a lot of questions itself. And actually, the show that I was originally aiming to do tonight, I didn't even get to. So this really is a bit of a warm-up for that one, I guess. I'll be very interested to see what you all think of this material, because it's not what we normally do on the Dr. Rock show. I was also due to have a guest today, but as is so often the case, my guest has ended up on the road, and so I shall be dealing with all of it myself. As it stands, however, if any of it strikes any bells, or if you feel like coming online and having a chat about any of these subjects that are going to be raised, then feel free to Skype me on dr.rock2012, that's dr.rock2012, and I'll endeavour to manage the call. The material itself is quite dense, although I hope lightly put, and so we'll manage it in chunks, and I'll play a couple of tunes in between these chunks to give you a bit of a rest and to make sure that I stay pretty much on the straight and narrow, as it were, because all of this stuff really sparks a lot of thoughts in me that are, I suppose, sometimes tangential to the main subject. So I need to try and make sure that I keep myself on track, otherwise I could be here for an awfully long time. So, given that we're going to be looking at the idea that the brain is treating the world holographically, and that the world which it's treating is may also be a holograph, it would probably be a good idea to just try and describe, for those people who don't know what a hologram is, just quickly how it works. Most of us have seen these things, like most commonly seen, I think, probably on credit cards and other similar pieces of plastic, where they're a very small, multicoloured object that looks fairly three-dimensional when you peer at it. Many of you, I'm sure, will have seen the much bigger holograms that are available. You can get them sort of A4 size and bigger than that, of course. And they're basically pictures that look really, really three-dimensional. The more light you get pouring into these things, the more three-dimensional they appear. So there's information encoded in there, which responds to light levels and various other things. The hologram I've got shows, the main picture on it is the head of an owl peering out at you, and with sunshine behind it, it really does look 3D. It looks like it's hanging in front of the glass behind which it is actually framed. This particular hologram's also got another couple of birds in it. If you turn the thing slightly to the left, you get an amazingly 3D picture of some sort of eagle, and if you turn it a couple of degrees or so to the right, you get another complete picture, this time of some as yet unidentified fish-catching bird. And pretty spectacular they are. The technology that makes them is really pretty modern, but as we shall hear, it's got a fine history to it over the last 150 years or so. But as it stands, I've seen many descriptions of holograms, or holographs as they're called, and this is one of the best ones that I came across. And it says that if you drop a pebble into a pond, it will produce a series of regular waves that travel outwards in concentric circles. Drop two identical pebbles into the pond at different points, and you will get two sets of similar waves that move towards each other. Where the waves meet, they will interfere. If the crest of one hits the crest of the other, they will work together and produce a wave of twice the normal height. If the crest of one coincides with the trough of another, they will cancel each other out and produce an isolated patch of calm water. In fact, all possible combinations of the two occur, and the final result is a complex arrangement of ripples known as an interference pattern. And light waves behave in exactly the same way as the water waves do. The purest kind of light available to us at the moment is that produced by a laser, which sends out a beam in which all of the waves are of one frequency, coherent light. So it's a bit like the ripples made by an ideal pebble in a perfect pond. When the two laser beams touch, they produce an interference pattern of light and dark ripples that can be recorded on a photographic plate. And if one of the beams, instead of coming directly from the laser, is reflected first off an object, such as a human face, the resulting pattern will be very complex indeed, but it can still be recorded. The record will be a hologram of the human face. And the point here is that the hologram doesn't store every point of information on the face in a sort of correlating spot on the photographic plate. What it does is it spreads the information of every single point that it's recording over the entire plate, such that every part of the holographic image contains the whole image. So if I were to take the one I've described with the three birds, the three-dimensional bird's heads on it, and throw it to the floor and pick up one of the pieces, what I would see is still all three of the birds and still all three of their heads. The picture, in other words, as it stands, would be complete. You'd be missing a little bit of the 3D-ness, and you'd be missing a bit of colour and probably a bit of definition as well. And you'd lose more depending on how small the bits are. But by and large, all of the information that's in the whole thing is recorded in the tiny bit, which is fundamentally what it was that Bohm and Pribram are interested in. So any piece of the hologram will reconstruct the entire image. Somehow the information that's encoded in a part is also encoded in the whole. The pattern on the holographic plate has no space-time dimension, thus the image is stored everywhere on the plate, which is another point that's important as far as our, it's going to turn out to be important as far as our consciousness is concerned and the way our universe is constructed, it seems. The other thing that's turned out to be really useful about this particular thing for modern technologies is that it is possible using these technologies to store billions of bits of information in a tiny, tiny place. And broadly speaking, the proposition that's being made is that the brain, our brains, and the cosmos are in some way strewed along similar holographic lines, such that everything is both the container and the content of everything else. So we become manifestors of, as well as manifestations within, the matrix within which we find ourselves living. And actually, holography is not merely a means of recording images on a photographic plate. It's also conceptually really powerful as a metaphorical tool, which is why so many people have been referring to it, and I think it's probably where some of the confusion has arisen. A metaphor, of course, is an apprehensible representation of things that are less easily described than itself. Many new words have been coined to deal with the challenges that are arising in modern physics. And one of the ones that arose in the not-too-distant past, I think it was back in 1977, there was a group formed that called themselves the Holonomics Group. And the word holonomics, when I last looked in a pretty new Oxford dictionary, is still not in there, which is not entirely surprising, given what it is. What the Holonomics Group wanted to denote by the word and by their activities was the unified and impartial study of the pattern of law and purpose of the universe as a whole. Holonomics is a holistic theory and is considered to be a new approach to fundamental knowledge, adopting an holistic mode of thinking and action and aiming to coordinate and integrate the approaches of science, philosophy, religion, personal experience, ethics, and the arts, and to have direct applications to the human situation. Now, first off, that really reminds me of all the descriptions I've read of alchemy and alchemists. They seemed to be extremely keen on integrating the internal and the external. They were paying attention to the state of the stars at the moment of whatever they were doing, the horoscopes of whoever it was that was working with them, as many things as they could possibly bring together to bring to bear on whatever the challenge was that they were trying to deal with. This appears to be a similar approach. And of course, it's pretty refreshing. We heard when we talked about Rupert Sheldrake and Bruce Lipton on the show, how partial and biased and fragmented modern science is, to the point where it really is practically a religion. And in fact, I think Bruce Lipton actually says at some point that after years of scientific training and study and doing the research papers and getting himself a professorship or lectureship or whatever it was he was doing, that he eventually woke up, he awoke one day to realize that it was religion he was teaching and not science. So, first of all, anything that is offering an impartial study has got to be a move forward. It's also looking at the pattern of law and purpose. As we're going to hear, one of the results of fragmenting the way we look at what is a unified cosmos is that we completely lose any impression of pattern. There you go, we're going to get a bit of a visit from the household phone there. We might also get a visit from Goji the dog in a bit. I'm just going to leave it ringing now. I'm sure it'll stop eventually. So they're looking for patterns and purpose of the whole. And one of the things that's going to become very clear in this investigation is that neither purpose nor the nature of the whole or even its existence is actually even considered by quantum mechanics, by modern physical theory. They're also looking at whole thinking and action. They're actually tying together thinking and aiming to coordinate all of this stuff. Hiya, Jan. Thank you. Very good. So, yeah, whole thinking and action and aiming to coordinate and integrate. And again, it's quite clear, not only from Sheldrake, but from many other critics of modern scientific theory and practice, that that again is exactly the opposite of what by and large is going on in science. Some would argue, of course, that this in fact is what science should be, and that in that kind of definition, science as it stands is not what many scientists are doing. And a bit like Bruce Lipton's awakening to the quantum nature of cell biology, the first man to do that really, and to realize that that what he was looking at was a wholly new set, a wholly new structure of all of the data, having learned about cell biology using Newtonian theory, to realize that the quantum world, as described by modern physical theory, must, if it applies to anything, it must apply to everything, and that would include humanity, human beings, and everything around them. And that obviously completely changed his paradigm. And when we talk about a paradigm shift, which is what both Bohm and Pribram expect to arise from the realization of this stuff, is where effectively coming up, we're imagining a state which answers the old riddle, the riddle which asks what happens when an unstoppable force touches an immovable object. And the answer to the riddle is that the unstoppable force stops and the immovable object moves, which means that all of the things that were thought to be true before that particular moment can no longer be taken to be true. And this is really the kind of situation that we're looking at here with these kind of theories. Consciousness is not only a bit of a mystery, but it's also more or less ignored by science to a great extent. And when it is studied, it tends to be deeply mechanistic and divisive. One of the important things to note about this new breakthrough is that it's not simply a discussion. It does actually fulfill a couple of predictions that were made concerning this long-awaited theory. One is that it would draw on theoretical mathematics. This is not, as we shall hear, a wholly satisfactory way of judging success in one's scientific endeavours. But on this particular case, Bohm's own elegant theory, which remained for a long time mathematically unvalidated, has in fact now been validated by his friend and co-worker Basil Hiley. And Bohm didn't validate it himself, mostly because, as far as I can gather, he wasn't actually very interested in the mathematics of physics. He could do it, but it wasn't where his energy and his love and passion lay. What Bohm really wanted to do, luckily for us, I think, is he thought it was most important for any kind of science, if it was going to be able to call itself science, that it should be communicable to the common man. And so Bohm spends a lot of time concentrating on his language and making sure that his ideas are clear and lucid enough for people with, I guess, a basic sort of knowledge to be able to come to grips with. But I remember when Hiley came off, pulled this stunt off, because he turned up at a place where I was on a course at the time into matter and consciousness. And he turned up to talk to the tutors on this particular course. And there was a lot of excitement, because it does mean that we have got an interpretation now of quantum mechanics that is considerably more workable than what appears to me, I must admit, to be complete madness. Once you start looking at it, it really is a mishmash of stuff. And Bohm spent a lot of time trying to put together something which is seamless. The other thing that it's really necessary that any kind of breakthrough along these lines actually achieves is that it manages to establish the supernatural, as we call it, or the paranormal, as part of nature. And one of the reasons it has to do that is because, of course, the paranormal and the supernatural have to be part of nature. They have to be part of what's going on the planet. It can only be that way. The fact that they have to be called supernatural or paranormal is merely an indication of the impoverishment of the scientific techniques and that are being used to investigate them, and the explanations that are arising as a result of those investigations. One of the things that's said by this is that phenomena of altered states of consciousness, with which I'm sure many of us are aware, personal investigations into these realms, these altered states of consciousness are reflections of altered brain states, and they may be due to a literal attunement to the invisible matrix that generates concrete reality. And this may enable, they argue, interaction with reality at a primary level, thereby accounting for precognition, psychokinesis, healing, time distortion, rapid learning, experience of oneness with the universe, the conviction that the ordinary reality is an illusion, and descriptions of a void that is paradoxically full. There's a whole mixture of things there, some of which I reckon every single one of us will in one way or another be familiar with, will certainly have heard of them all. And we're aware that through history, there have been many people who've experienced and written fantastic first-hand accounts of experience of oneness with the universe and of encounters with a void that is paradoxically full. Indeed, I've spoken before about a couple of books that are particularly good on that subject, written by a couple of men who have experienced just that, experienced this, this mystical oneness, the dissolution of boundaries between them, the perceived boundaries between their physical selves and the universe, realizing suddenly and more or less out of the blue that they are part of the cosmic background. Those two books, for the ones that didn't hear it before, are called As It Is by Tony Parsons. And it's important to get the English publication, the English print of that book, because there is an American one also called As It Is, which contains only the dialogues at the back of the English book. The English book actually describes the experience of coming to this kind of deal with the world, changing your view of it, changing your view of it and your view of yourself in it. And it comes as a result of insight, or it did to Tony Parsons. That is, by the way, not the commonly known Tony Parsons, but a slightly less, but much more deserving, in my opinion, of fame, slightly less commonly known Tony Parsons. But Tony Parsons, as it is, absolutely brilliant little book. I still read it quite often, actually. The other one is a little bit more difficult, but quite a lot more extensive, and is called Perfect Brilliant Stillness by David Kass, which explains his much more tumultuous experience with the whole thing and his consequent visits to various mystics in part of the world to try and get them to explain to him just exactly what it was that had happened. The output of that investigation makes for some really great reading, and that book is also full of really fantastic little quotes from all these old masters who might actually have been reading Bohm's and Pribram's work before they said the things that they said. So it may turn out that the Taoists were right. The real is empty, and the empty is real. Really, though, if we can come up with a reasonable explanation for precognition and psychokinesis and so many of the other things that, as Sheldrake points out, we haven't got any really good explanation for. I mean, science itself is still battling with homeopathy, with complementary medicines of all sorts, and yet is being forced to take them on board. We know that after years of wrangling, the NHS did eventually take on chiropractic and acupuncture. And I know of some very good people who are working there at the moment, trying to convert people to things like kinesiology and all the rest of it. So in a way, there must be an awareness of this sort of stuff being right. Otherwise, it wouldn't be being taken on. And as I said, it can only be part of our everyday experience of the Matrix, because there's good evidence for all of these things. It's just because they don't meet the predictions of science and, I guess, can't be measured by their instruments. They tend to be, like so many other things, just subtracted out of the equation. But this kind of theory's got to be worth investigation, I would have thought, just on those grounds. And these kind of theories might explain how it is that these things work, because parapsychologists have spent a lot of their time searching, as yet it would appear in vain, for the energy that is responsible for transmitting telepathy and psychokinesis, i.e. the thought that travels from one head to another, carrying whatever the thought is that's being transmitted. Or what is the force, what is the energy that's moving an object when somebody isn't actually touching it? How is it that we can actually heal people by, say, as has been well shown, I think, that we can actually affect the health of people by looking simply at the statistics in the past of what happened to them, if they haven't been examined before, by assigning a degree of meditation or prayer to each groups of a bunch of random numbers, you apparently and demonstrably affect the outcome, even though you're doing that work several years down the line from when the healing took place. We know that even in physical surgery, which is somewhere where this kind of spontaneous healing would have thought be expected. I have heard it said that the placebo does not exist in surgery. But once again, we know that there was a knee surgeon, whose name I can't remember, who decided that he was going to do a bit of an experiment. He decided he was going to try and find out whether the placebo actually occurred in these things, in physical operations or not. And so he divided his unwitting patients into a couple of groups, and he operated on one lot and the other lot. He simply made incisions and then did all the things that he would have done if he was doing the operation. So he made all the right noises and kind of swished around the place and turned things on and off and whatever else they do. And then sewed up the little incision. And he was amazed to find that 2 years after this particular experiment, there was actually no difference between the people on whom he had operated and the people on whom he had pretended to operate. And the latter group actually included a basketball player who, and obviously, I mean, I don't think anybody has operations on their knees unless they absolutely need it. But this guy, of course, it was, if you like, it was his profession. felt he had to have it, and in fact he was one of the ones who didn't have an operation, but he was playing basketball just as fine as if he had. Some of us might say possibly even finer. But if these energies that are doing the moving of objects and the healing and the mind transfer and all of that, if these energies emerge from frequencies that transcend time and space, they don't have to be transmitted because they're potentially simultaneous and everywhere. Which is exactly what David Bohm's theory indicates is the case. Altered brain states, of course, are an alteration in the chemistry which attunes itself differently to the invisible matrix with the with whatever the chemical is. It attunes itself differently to the invisible matrix that generates the apparently concrete reality. And so the mind that has been altered breaks away from the consensus, such as it is. I'll talk a little bit more about the invisible matrix and concrete reality later, because neither of them are quite as they appear. But I think it is perhaps helpful to realize that our brain states and our neurochemical responses are fundamentally our experience. They are our most fundamental response to and interpretation of the world in which we find ourselves moment to moment. So as stuff occurs, your endocrine glands, amongst other glands, pump hormones into the bloodstream, which instantly and even in tiny amounts affect system-wide response. And those chemicals are what is basically making us feel a liking for something or a disliking for it, wanting to stay in a place or not stay in a place. All of those things are initially little chemical messages that are coming to the brain and to the endocrine system. And as a result, things like our pulse rate increase, pupils dilate, alimentary tract contracts, hairs stand on end, loads of things. They're all chemical things, but they are our instant experience. They are the things to which our reality is requiring us to respond in the moment. And somehow we appear to have become really confused about all of this, and we enable our responses to these chemical rushes to become embedded. It's embedded by the ego, which feels it's been hurt by something or rewarded by something. It doesn't matter which, as we know. Gets further embedded by emotion, which effectively, it appears to me, stops motion. It stops movement forward and prevents people from dealing with stuff in the moment when it was actually designed to be dealing with. And we all know, of course, I'm sure that everybody who's listening to this now knows that our responses are then further embedded by the use of words, all of which have got implications and suppositions and conditioning attached to them. They're all spells, so they all further embed this, what should be an instantaneous thing, and make it hang around and give it a bit of drag, what David Bohm would call pollution. And then there's all manner of other chemical and psychosocial manipulations that are effectively limiting our expression of and response to actual reality, actual experience. So all of this becomes very confused in us. And in a world which we now know, we absolutely know, to a level still to be determined, is an illusion, then comprehending that we are interacting with reality at some primary level, if indeed that's what we're doing, and I think many of us certainly believe that to be the case, then understanding that, knowing that we are interacting with this reality at a primary level, might well turn out to be helpful. So, Pribram's work is quite complex, and really tonight is more to concentrate on David Bohm's, which concerns the holographic nature of the reality rather than the holographic nature of the brain. But it is worth looking at some of the things he did and said. He's basically arguing that reality, this whole thing, everything that we see around us, including ourselves, including mind, including the consciousness, including all the neurochemicals and our responses and the embedding of them and everything is a special case constructed by the mathematics of the brain, yet drawn from a domain beyond time and space where only frequencies exist. The question is, who is looking at the hologram? And what is the hologram a hologram of? Which seems to be the thing that really fired Pribram up. He's made a lot of progress in his time as a scientist, but his work has become more and more exciting as he's got more and more into it. And that sort of question is the kind of thing that's really been bothering mystics and philosophers, as far as I can gather, ever since there's been mystics and philosophers. I mean, the question itself was more or less the same one as stymied Aristotle. And Pribram basically concluded that if it stymied everybody between Aristotle and him, then it might well be the wrong question. And so he decided to ask, what if the real world isn't made up of objects at all? What if the world itself is actually the hologram? And there must have been many experiences in his neurosurgery work and in the research that went around it that brought that question up. But there's many other questions that rushed into his mind as well, and they're questions that I've heard asked by many other people. One of the main ones, of course, is how did many of the extraordinary insights of mystics and early philosophers precede scientific verification for centuries, by centuries? Well, we know there's a bit of fiddling about there. We know that some people have actually got a much better record of history than other people. We know it's been well shown that India, maybe 3,500 BC, had a significantly more advanced knowledge of, for example, human anatomy than we've got nowadays in the medical service, and that they were capable of doing many, many of the things that we do nowadays, and also that many of the things we do nowadays we do more or less exactly the same way as they did, but probably with a bit more filth, poor training, incompetence, and lack of resource. There you go. One of the things that particularly puzzled Pribram was the early metaphysical description of the pineal gland as the third eye. It's only really recently been confirmed, as far as anything is confirmed by science, that our pineal gland is something of a super master gland. It's part of the endocrine system that I was talking about a bit earlier. But it does regulate through the production of melatonin, the outputs of the pituitary gland. And until recently, it was the pituitary gland which was thought to be the master gland, which is how come the pineals in this hierarchical world has got itself the allocation of super master gland. Actually, if you look even at the word of even at the work of materialist scientists who are interested in consciousness, it seems that those organs, the pituitary and the pineal, are themselves engaged in some kind of energetic data dance, which is orchestrated and coordinated by the hypothalamus. It's not exactly itself part of the endocrine system, but is very important part of how it all manages itself. And even the hypothalamus appears to be a bit of a hyperspatial, hypertemporal unit. It's got many, many things going on in it at once, and it seems to deal outside time with the pituitary and the pineal and other aspects of our system. And yet there appears to have been quite a fair knowledge of all of this. There's many other things, I guess, because mystical questions enter into this. How did shamanic cultures worldwide discover the enzyme inhibiting properties of certain plants that enabled them to make productive use of visionary concoctions such as ayahuasca? How did they know that they needed to inhibit certain enzymes in order to enable this visionary substance to work in the human body? How could they know that if they didn't have some sort of connection with the wider world from which they were getting this information? And these studies are absolutely littered with these questions. As we look at alternative history, as we look at mysticism, as we look at philosophy, even actually as we look at the history of religion, which does appropriate a lot of genuine human experience to itself and make it look like it's part of something else, there's many, just countless examples of things that it's difficult to explain our ancestors knowing. So how did these ideas arise for millennia before we had the mathematics to understand them? And the mathematics, although we can't really understand it, does underlie all of these things. Fortunately, these two characters are particularly good with words as well. Pribram suggests that maybe in the holographic state, in the frequency domain, 4,000 years ago is tomorrow, or indeed yesterday. So, actually, Pribram's work, as you go through it, it encompasses such a vast spectrum of ideas about human consciousness. Throughout the time he's been doing it, he's addressed in several different ways, actually, learning, learning disorders, imagination, meaning, perception, intention, as well as paradoxes of brain function, of which there are many. He basically says that interactions between synapses, which are like nerve junctions in the brain, interactions between them and fine fibers that branch from, they're called axons, but they're like sort of thread-like structures that carry impulses from the brain cell. And he's saying that interactions between these synapses and axons may manifest as slow waves with the potential to carry out mathematics. They always use the word may. They're quite careful not to say does. But these are ideas now that I think have become pretty well established. It's been discovered that as well as having digital and linear connections working a bit like a computer, the brain, also like a computer, has parallel processing capacity that is formed by connections traversed by paths of light. Absolutely amazing that certain aspects of the brain are driven directly by light, like fiber optics. And energetically, these thoughts, as they move across the synapses, they're not exactly junctions. I gather there's a synaptic cleft. There's a little gap between one and the other, which means all of these thoughts and signals at some stage leap into a frequency realm. They leap away from the physical structure of the brain and spend some time obviously a very fine amount of time hanging between one place and another before they arrive. It appears that our total sensory and kinesthetic input, everything that we get from our environment, the sense of touch, wind, colour, smell, taste, all of the things kind of conspire somewhere in the mind, somewhere in the brain, to create a point perception which leaps out into space in front of us in a very 3D fashion. And 3D is something I talk about quite a lot in the geometry talk that I do, because it is possible for us to pull three dimensions, very realistic looking three dimensions, out of a flat piece of card that's just got whirly lines on it. It's all a bit unnerving. And that is part of this, this kinesthetic creation of what appears to be a real world. And it's, in principle, it's exactly the same way as a hi-fi works. Most of us are familiar now that when you sit in different bits of the room, you might want to adjust the balance on the hi-fi to make the sound appear that it's coming from between the two speakers. And even though you absolutely know, understand and comprehend that the sound is coming from two speakers, or probably maybe even 8 or 10 nowadays if you're lucky, that it sounds like it's coming from the middle of the room, and no amount of your trying to attune that otherwise is going to make your consciousness believe it's anywhere other than the middle of the room. Well, that's simply an audio version that we can all understand of what is actually happening kinesthetically to our interpretation of the world around us. In an amplifier, of course, these kind of phenomena involve alternation of phase and frequency relationships by using variable resistors and the knobs that are attached to them. But when this sort of alteration happens in the brain, when this kind of figuring, this kind of placing of reality in front of us, is in the mind, it's biochemical, these alterations that are made. So that system can be changed pretty effectively, as we know, by taking quite a lot of different things. But those complex phase relationships and alternations and frequency relationships and stuff are just being done by the mind, by the brain. Somehow it's constantly coordinating all this stuff to keep it in the right place. there have been substantial observations made now of people who are experiencing transcendental experience, because there are many people who have had enough practice to do this pretty much as a matter of course, and it's now possible using MRI scans to be able to see which bits of the brain are active when this kind of thing happens. This is one of the instruments that was used by Pribram's team to show that every time a memory of anything, even quite simple things, is called up, it uses, there's like a shimmering pattern that occurs all over the brain, as if it's kind of seeking bits of information from everywhere and putting them together somehow. And using MRI scans on people who are experiencing transcendental experience has suggested a possible role for a set of particular circuits, and there are many different sets of circuits in the brain. These particular ones center on the amygdala, which is another very peculiar structure. But I was interested, particularly this time through, it's a long time since I've looked at this material, probably 10 or 15 years, but knowing what we know now to how much we are being managed rather than being allowed instinctively to do what we like, this amygdala is a structure that's linked to emotions, it's linked to aggression, and its functions include the control of fear responses, arousal, secretion of hormones, which, as I've said, are part of all of this system anyway, and the formation of emotional memories. Memories are important things, but they're not what we all might think they are. And these particular circuits, not only as well as being involved in all of those other things, which are quite clearly interesting parts of modern society and parts of our own cultural conditioning that keep us where we are, these circuits also control feedback and feed-forward mechanisms of the brain, because it does pass information in both directions. And these circuits have also been found to be the site on occasion of pathological disturbances, as well as déjà vu and the famous and ever sought for consciousness without content. So there's some very interesting correlations going on in there. There is also a fundamental similarity between the way the brain manages information, or the way the brain appears to manage information as interpreted by the machines that are being used to watch it. I lost myself there. Sorry, that does happen occasionally. I just looked at the fireplace and it went straight out of my head. Might come back, might not. Never mind, I'll move on for the moment. Oh, that's right, yeah, I remember what it was. It was that the way quantum mechanical mathematical theory manifests itself, the actual transformation algorithms that are used in determining what potential thing might be coming, what other potential thing in the experiments and in the equations, are more or less identical, as far as I can gather, and obviously I don't understand them, but they're identical to the transformations that are being made in the brain when it's processing its memories and everything. And there are other really close similarities between the theory that underlies quantum mechanics and how the brain appears to be working. And the implications of this are, for every aspect of human life, as well as for science, are really quite profound. The new theory, it seems at least, has got awesome implications in terms of the individual's potential to affect his life, his reality, and impressive power to unify as well disparate discoveries in consciousness research that remain disparate, as I said, because of the possibly because of the poor scientific approach that's being used to them. And this is something that does, as it turns out, have more or less sort of personal applications. One of the things that's come out of it is that anxiety is known to undermine the ability to learn. From my point of view, anxiety actually can undermine the ability to operate, full stop. If there's enough sources of anxiety, or they're big enough, it makes it really difficult to run the brain, even to do the things that it really likes doing normally. It can sometimes even not want to eat or drink or what have you. But they concentrated on the ability to learn and said that anxiety is like a kind of static. It's like a noisier, arrhythmic state. And that by taking a deeper understanding of the brain by actually looking at it as a complex frequency analyzer, it's thought that it might engender greater respect for individual differences in learning style, if, of course, individual differences in learning style were of any interest at all to the people who purport to be educating us. Individual responsibility for health becomes underscored because it's fully apparent in this kind of paradigm that there's access to a primary realm of reality that creates illness or wellness, which of course is not to say that environmental factors are not important, although once again there's many examples, and I know one or two people myself who have been really very, very, very sick, and only with their own kind of mental intervention, say by lying in their hospital bed and personally visiting their cells in some sort of imagined state, have managed to just make themselves well again. We know it happens a lot. It's a lot less uncommon than we might think it is. And of course it happens a lot more than we really know, because presumably people are doing it all the time and are just not being watched. It's been noticed that a combination of imagery with altered states of consciousness, and these would include meditation, hypnosis, psychosynthesis, many different things can work. They make sense if the image interacts with a simultaneous everywhere state of all possibility. It's also possible that if all of this is right, that figurative descriptions, we've all heard of a sense of flow that comes typically with periods of love and joy and confidence, the points at which we're feeling particularly well sorted, the sense of flow, the sense of things moving more freely in the creative process as well. All of these may reflect an actual resonance with a sort of wave aspect of reality. And if that's the case, anxiety, anger and stuckness would represent fragmented states away from the holon. Under these circumstances, even transcendence itself, which is something I really do like to believe is a coming potency on the planet, it somehow seems to me to be right. It might turn out, according to these ideas anyway, as some sort of phase relationship between two processes of the brain, a sort of literal description of when the brain comes into tune with itself, and achieves a balance, say, between the analytical and the holistic, or perhaps we might call it the intellectual and the intuitive, like particles and waves, really, that these two different things may come together and completely transform the way the brain interprets the apparent world. We know also that attention is very poorly understood. It's another really mysterious part of consciousness research, which there's really some outrageous experiments to see what the brain is capable of doing under certain extreme circumstances. But like some biofeedback patients can cure migraines by raising their hand temperature. So they get a migraine and they imagine that the temperature of their hands is going up, and that gets rid of the migraine. Others do it by lowering the temperature of their hand, making the hand go colder. So it would appear from those investigations and many other like them that it's the quality of our attention that might be more important than the actual learning of physiological self-control, that how we're paying attention to ourselves makes a difference to what happens to us. Another thing that these things might help us to explain are what are called apparent universals in aesthetic quality. And these are things that we see throughout time. It's thought that these universals may, in the end, show that they're reflecting an underlying symmetry or underlying frequencies, phase relationships to which our brains respond. And my personal experience of people's response to sacred to geometry, geometric form generally, and especially to the sacred or golden proportion, to phi, could just be such reflections. It's been commented many times that when I'm out doing the geometry with all of the geometry in front of me, there is barely any chance to get a break at half time, because what happens is the crowd floods towards the geometry. They want to interact with it. They want to handle it. Everybody's got different favorites and all of that, but there is something about the structure of these things that does seem to have universal appeal. Obviously, everybody's had to choose to come to the Sacred Geometry Talk in the first place, but you can quite often see that a few of them are feeling deeply experimental and uncertain about it. But honestly, once you start showing them the geometry, they get really engaged. In fact, I quite often say that really I could just hang all the geometry up bit by bit, let people think about it, and I'm only spoiling the silence. The geometry is doing all the work. And I firmly believe that there are actual like phase relationships between our inner selves, our energetic bodies, and these external items. And of course, to a certain extent, that resonant quality, that interaction can be shown by the use of kinesiology or the dowsing of the human energy system, which can show quite demonstrably connections between our inner state and certain items that are surrounding us. People who are on the psychiatric bandwagon also feel that the holographic model is possibly valuable. There's a character called Edgar Levinson who pointed out that the hologram is a valuable model for the phenomenon of insight or sudden change in psychotherapy. And we keep coming across this word insight, which Bohm uses a lot as well. It's a valuable model for the phenomenon of insight or sudden change in psychotherapy. And that since such changes take place across the spectrum of psychoanalytic methods, and there are many, it must therefore be due to something other than the specific approach. Sudden or insidious, dramatic, or by default, change doesn't come at the behest of any technique or procedure. Like the mystical or the aesthetic, the psychoanalytic experience is capricious and unreliable. The therapist appears to resonate. Oh, we noticed the other day that the therapist is actually the rapist when you break it down, which made us chuckle. But anyway, the therapist resonates with something the patient already knows and brings it into clearer focus. The change results as a consequence of the expansion of configurational patterns over time. It seems to me that everyday encounters with everyday folk can work exactly like this. In a world where everyone is in denial or is under some sort of glamour, much of what we say can resonate with something our interlocutor already knows, and this can engender sudden insight, as I said, of which a bit more later. So it's also, I also noticed a resonance between this idea that that there's a kind of relationship somehow built between the therapist and the patient based on something the patient already knows. As we're dealing with apparent figures of authority in the world management team, it may be that that's exactly the kind of that's the kind of interaction, if you like, that is getting us safer results than the disjointed, fragmented reaction of actually having a go trying to teach them something, actually relating to them more as a therapist might who knows might work. Mind you, I suppose in the proper position, given as we're asking the questions, it's we're the therapist, and under those circumstances, perhaps they're the patient. Who knows? But it does seem to me that there are correlations, similarities between these various encounters. Actually, Levinson, I think, quoted Priam's holographic model of brain function and David Bohm's concept of the holographic enfolded level of reality a few times in the way he was using his stuff. So I'm going to have a quick break here, get myself a glass of water, and give you all a rest. This is, of course, tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. I'll play a couple of tunes and then come back with a brief history of where these ideas came from. Crawling from the wreckage there, and ain't that just what we're doing? So, like many of these ideas, it has been growing for a long time. The moving spirit that started kicking the ball, as it were, appears to have been the old Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz, who is somebody who seems to pop into so many different subjects, it's quite astonishing. He said that a metaphysical reality underlies and generates the material universe, which is exactly what Bohm's saying. He claims that space-time, mass, and the motion of physics and transfer of energies are intellectual constructs. Leibniz also discovered integral and differential calculus, which were going to be crucial to the development of the laser beam and the hologram. and he also maintained that the exquisitely orderly behaviour of light indicated an underlying radical patterned order of reality, another thing which Bohm claims to be validating. He also came up with the idea of the perfect monad, which is comes from the Greek for stability, unity, and basically aloneness. We might call it the face of the deep before spirit moved, the perfect thing that existed before it decided to try and experience polarity, the whole, as it were. And according to Leibniz, rather holographically, all of the consciousnesses that are currently moving around in this cosmos are little monads, monads with a small m. Each of them is a spark of the original consciousness, the monad with a big M. And each of them, each of these little monads, refers to the whole, but with different degrees of completion and perfection, just like the hologram. So he'd kind of intuited all this stuff, or he'd got access to paperwork from the past, of course. The next man up was couple hundred years later, really, 1902, best part of 200 years, a character called William James proposed that the brain normally filters out a larger reality, and this has turned out to be the case. Consciousness research, again, indicates that actually the mind does not project into our consciousness necessarily what it is that the brain experiences, that somehow the mind looks to be as much a filter as it is a facilitator. This again is something that is becoming more convincing as time goes by. Henri Bergson, 5 years after William James, 1907, said that the ultimate reality is a vital impulse comprehensible only by intuition. The brain once again screens out a larger reality. Where Bergson basically is considering intuition here, both Bohm and Krishnamurti identify insight as a key to our comprehension of the world beyond thought. 1929, 20 years down the line, another very famous character, well worth looking into, Alfred Whitehead. He was a mathematician and philosopher, a pretty fearsome character really. He described nature, I love this, he described nature as a great expanding nexus of occurrences, terminating in sense perception. So a kind of huge structure, if you like, of things, interstices of things, and that sense perception is the thing that arises out of it last of all. The ancient Maya, of course, believed that there are many levels below the level we live in, and that right down the bottom are some people chanting some simple words, and a level above that, slightly more complicated words, and a level above that, until at some point what we get is a perception of the material world. So that I thought was quite interesting, the kind of connection between Whitehead and shamanic peoples of the past. Whitehead says we only imagine that matter and mind are different when in fact they are interlocking. Bohm says, as we'll hear, that they are, that matter and mind are the same. Also in 1929, Carl Lashley published an extensive body of research demonstrating that specific memory is not to be found at any particular site in the brain, but is distributed throughout. And I think Pribram, as a young man, worked with Lashley for a period as well. Those are pretty grim experiments, really. Not worth going into in any detail, but fundamentally what is shown by them, the main things that appears to be shown, is that destroying a fair amount of the brain does not appear to destroy entirely learned behaviours. It might impair it a little bit, but by and large, extensive brain damage can occur, and most memories remain intact. In fact, I think it was specifically it wasn't Lashley's work, it was somebody else's, but your salamander is a particularly interesting creature in this regard, because apparently you can mush its brain completely and it still remembers entirely how to be a salamander. So just exactly how that works as well, obviously, is a complete mystery. If the brain and the mind are what we say they are, how on earth can that possibly be happening? As I say, once you get into consciousness research, it's full of really bizarre things like that. It wasn't until 1947, relatively recently, that a character called Dennis Gabor used Leibniz's calculus to describe a potential three-dimensional photography. And in 1965, this potential became potency. as Emmett Leaf and another character whose name I can't remember announced the successful construction of holograms with the newly invented laser beam. So 1965, the actual artifacts that are being used as metaphors here came into being. In 1969, Pribram proposed that the hologram was a powerful model for brain processes, and then he encountered he had encountered David Bohm's work by then, and I think in 1971 Bohm proposed that the universe itself might be holographic. And it was in, so there we go, it was in 75 that Pribram synthesized his theories and Bohm's in a publication on Gestalt psychology. I enjoyed particularly that a Gestalt is defined as an organized whole that is perceived to be more than the sum of its parts. As I said, Pribram's made quite a lot of progress in his time, showing, I think, that he's actually been engaged in real science, because he has been changing his mind as he finds out things. He's been moving, and in the 40s he was described as a staunch behaviorist. He believed in a simple stimulus and response model. This is basically a Skinnerian or Pavlovian conditioning. Ring a bell to make the dog dribble, or make its legs go stiff, or make the rat press the pellet if it's going to get a food pellet, press the bar if it's going to get a food pellet, and discourage it from pressing the bar by giving it an electric shock. Simply stimulus and response. No psychology, just mechanistic, if you like, in the 1940s, deeply mechanistic approach to the behaviour of animals and humans. And so inevitably, I think he realised eventually that more subjective experience had to be studied if brain research was going to make any progress at all. And he and his co-authors unoriginally enough called their approach subjective behaviourism. Pribram's group were among the first to use computer modelling to understand aspects of thought and behaviour. That was statistical as well as scans and the like. But one of their most dramatic contributions was the discovery that the brain's motor centres, the ones that are responsible for moving it around and learning how to use the limbs and lift things and all the other stuff, that they were involved not only in movement, but they actually share quite a lot of their energy in thought processes that precede movement, actual plans of action. That is another bizarre area of consciousness research, in that there appears to be quite a substantial gap, several seconds, between the brain deciding that it's going to lift an arm and actually lifting the arm. This is part of the theory which suggests that the brain as much, or the brain is to a certain extent concealing stuff or operating on a different level from the mind. It also became clear as a result of that, like that same research, that there's a critical neurological connection between the motor centers of the brain and learning. And this verifies a link that's been suspected by educational psychologists for a long time. Consciousness research suggests that the effectiveness of acquisition of physical learning is critically key to the effectiveness of mental learning. The two things appear to be intimately connected, and that if you don't learn to get about, it can impair many other things. Francis of Assisi, like Pribram, was interested in who was doing the looking. What is the nature of the ghost in the machine, was effectively the question being asked. And he answered his own question by concluding that what we are looking for is what is looking, which is itself a beautifully holographic solution to the problem. But it really was when Pribram encountered the theories of David Bohm that some possible answers to his difficult questions started to become apparent to him. One of the things that Bohm says is that what appears to be a stable, tangible, visible, audible world is an illusion. It is dynamic and kaleidoscopic, not really there. What we normally see is the explicit or unfolded order of things, rather like watching a movie. But there's an underlying order that is mother and father to this second generation reality. And he called that other order the implicate or enfolded order. The enfolded order harbours our reality, much as the DNA in the nucleus of the cell harbours potential life and directs the nature of its unfolding. And this underlying order is merely one underlying order. It is imagined that beyond that are other orders of which we cannot even really conceive. But as I say, what we seem to be looking at here is an apparently sound physical theory with mathematical validation and all the rest of it, which reads like a lot of David Bohm's work, it has to be said, like the readings of, in this case, a kind of society that understands that there are levels below and above this one. And is using that as there's a continuity, if you like, between information that we get from the perennial wisdom and from ancient peoples and what's being discovered by modern scientists. One of the experiments that Bohm uses a lot to describe what's going on with his unfolded and enfolded order is a very clever system they built, which is basically two perspex tubes, one within the other, and in between the two tubes is a gap. And the gap is filled with glycerine, which is a thick and viscous liquid. And it's possible slowly but surely to swirl round the glycerine, such that there's no shaking up or stirring. Things don't diffuse, they simply kind of wind into it. And the result is that it's possible to put a drop of ink into this viscous liquid and then slowly turn the machine a given number of times. And as you do that, the ink drop will kind of wind out. It will become thinner and thinner and longer until it disappears into the background of the viscous liquid. Now, the funny thing is that if you then rotate this mechanism in the other direction, the ink droplet can come back together again and reform. In the enfolded order, we see first of all that when we've taken the droplet and enfolded it, it's in the whole thing, and every part of the whole thing contributes to the droplet. So when it's disappeared, we can't see it, and the droplet itself is spread completely throughout, completely enfolded into this liquid. It's been enfolded into the hidden order and then unfolded back into the explicate order as it becomes visible or tangible to the senses, if you like, as the machine is reversed. If we actually imagine that several droplets get stirred into this fluid a different number of times and in different positions, and that the ink drops are stirred continuously and faster than the time resolution of our eye and consciousness, what will appear to us is that a single permanently existing ink drop is continuously moving across the fluid. In fact, there's no such object. Rather, as Bohm puts it, there's a series of unfoldings giving the illusion of an object. Just so, all apparent substance and movement are illusory. They emerge from another more primary order of nature. Bohm called this, he called it the hollow movement. It's dynamic and changing. He didn't like holograph because it suggested something fixed and written down. Actually, in his book Wholeness and the Implicate Order, Bohm does a really amazing chapter on the nature of language, in which he tries to create or suggest how we might use a language which deals only with the interactions between things. So the movement, if you like, the interaction, the energy exchange between objects. He tries to get rid of subject and object entirely. Another very interesting idea, given what we know. And funnily enough, towards the end of his life, he actually had a couple of very interesting conferences with the Algonquin, who are a group of Native American tribes or peoples. And when he came across some of these, he realized that the kind of language he'd been painstakingly trying to devise for such a long time was exactly the kind of language used by these people. They did deal with the interactions between each other rather than with the separation that is habitually implied by subject and object. In his glycerin experiment, effectively, the glycerin and the ink drops as filaments represent the invisible matrix, as referred to earlier, the implicate or enfolded order. The ink drops as they appear represent concrete reality, such as it is, as previously mentioned, and they're called the explicate or unfolded order. And this really reminds us of Meister Eckhart, a German mystic who said a long time ago, God becomes and disbecomes, which again seems to be a pretty good description of the kind of thing that Bohm's talking about. The droplet is, of course, completely one with its glycerin background, whether it's appearing as a droplet or as a thread. It's also noticed that our very act of objectifying things, as we do habitually with our language and with our science, as in, say, an electron microscope or any other instrument, the actual act of looking alters that which we hope to see. Again, modern physics is full of examples of this. We're, say, looking to find the edges of the thing to make it sit still for a moment, when its true nature is in another order of reality where there are no things. It's as if we're bringing the observed into focus, but the blur is a more accurate representation. The blur itself is the basic reality. That, of course, is fundamentally Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. The fact that we can only know how fast something's going or where it is. We can't know both those things. And that, of course, is a form of blur in itself. What Pribram's suggesting is that the brain's mathematical transformations, which as said earlier, are similar to the mathematical transformations made in quantum mechanical experiments. These transformations actually make objects for us out of blurs or frequencies. They make them into sounds and colours and kinesthetic sensations and smells and tastes. Maybe reality isn't what we see with our eyes. Maybe if we didn't have the mathematics performed by the brain, we could know a world organised in the frequency domain. No space, no time, just events. Can reality be read out of that domain, we wonder? And of course, there's many people who say we are living in just that, a world organized in frequency domains, that space and time are constructs, illusions, especially time. It's also said that the brain's neural interference patterns, those mathematical processes again, may be identical to the primary state of the universe. Our mental processes are, in effect, made of the same stuff as the organizing principle behind the whole show. And that, of course, is the point that brought Bohm and Pribram together. And the idea that our mental processes, our minds, if you like, the way we apprehend the world in which we live, are made of the same stuff as the organizing principle of that process itself, again, is not new. The immaterial but orderly nature of the universe has been commented upon by physicists and astronomers alike, really. Again, plenty of evidence of it. The fathers of modern quantum science had to really address this stuff, because most of the things that they were realizing were so alien to their previous ideas that it was necessary for them to start thinking about the fundamental ground of being. And they all wrote in English, the language of physics, about these experiences. Astronomer James Jean said that the universe is more like a great thought than a great machine. Arthur Eddington, like James Jean's another astronomer, that the stuff of the universe is mind stuff. More recently, a cyberneticist, Davis Foster, described an intelligent universe whose apparent concreteness is generated by, in effect, cosmic data from an unknowable organized source. Now, in fairness, Pribram admits that really he doesn't understand any of this. When asked at a conference how he managed to go on and on standing up to well-reasoned arguments, because as I'm sure you can imagine, he's had a fair few critics, but his basic approach is to say that challenges like that have been happening to him ever since he got into science, and he'd always turned out to be right. He points out, if you're somewhere on the leading edge, you can't explain everything. If you knew all about it, it wouldn't be the leading edge. And he also says that any idea that does not seem bizarre at first, there is no hope. Again, that pretty much seems like quite a lot of the research and activity we're doing. It was in the 18th century that a philosopher called David Hume said that the human being is nothing more than a bundle of perceptions which succeed each other with inconceivable rapidity and are in perpetual flux and movement. And that, again, neatly anticipates Bohm's hollow movement by a couple of hundred years or so. The difference, as both Pribram and Bohm would point out, is that nowadays we have the maths, whereas Hume was doing natural or physical philosophy. The Sufis, Rumi, a Sufi mystic, said that men's minds perceive second causes, but only prophets perceive the action of the first cause. And that, again, is perfectly in tune with the fact that Bohm's suggestion that we see the unfolded order only. And perhaps it is true that you need to be a prophet to perceive the enfolded order, the first cause from which everything stems. But perhaps the best description of all of this stuff is only three lines from a particularly beautiful Buddhist sutra. And it says, "In the heaven of Indra, there is said to be a network of pearls, so arranged that if you look at one, you see all the others reflected in it. In the same way, each object in the world is not merely itself, but involves every other object, and in fact is every other object." I mean, really, if the nature of reality itself is holographic and the brain operates holographically, then the world is indeed, as Eastern religions have said, Maya. It's a kind of magic show. Its concreteness is, in some very real sense, an illusion. A mystical experience, Pribram says, is no more strange than many other phenomena in nature, such as, he quotes, the selective derepression of DNA to form first one organ and then another itself. A completely amazing process. And what he's saying is that there's many other processes that that the body does which are every bit as mysterious as mystical experience. He says if we get ESP or paranormal phenomena or even nuclear phenomena in physics, it simply means that we are reading out of some other dimension at that time. And in an ordinary way, we can't understand that. In a way, he's referring there to the famous quantum measurement problem, saying that this kind of subworld of subatomic particles and stuff, which we're trying to measure with equations and machinery, it might be down there. Nobody really knows what it is. And anyway, the only way we can look at it is through Newtonian machinery. We haven't actually got any way of looking at what's gone on there. We can only see what has just happened in theory, using big solid machinery of the old science, really. And Pribram reckons that on this basis, and it would appear that he's right, that productive scientists must be as ready to defend spirit as data. This, he says, is science as it was originally conceived, the pursuit of understanding. The days of the cold-hearted, hard-headed technocrat appear to be numbered. That, again, hopefully is an echo of the other work that we're doing. And it's something that I really would love to be true. That science is finally going to find its way back into the hands of people who are genuinely trying to draw some conclusions about the world, the people in it, and things that might be useful to us. To return to David Bohm and a little bit more about his enfolded, unfolded order and his hollow movement. He asks us to imagine once more back with his glycerin and ink drops, and he's asking us, we need to remember that these things can be sort of wound in and then rewound back again, so they can be an ink drop that's wound out and then rewound back to become the ink drop, the same apparent ink drop in the same apparent place. So it's not a kind of mixing like eggs are in a cake. You know, you can get the eggs out of a cake once you've finished mixing it. But he asks us to imagine a situation where, having had one droplet in there and wound it in, we put another droplet in different positions. And when they're enfolded, they sort of mix up with each other. So there's now two of them, both mixed so that you can no longer see them in the glycerin. He says they distribute through the whole, but they are interspersed with each other because they're both folded in. They interpenetrate each other. This is an interpenetration within the whole, and we must make a distinction between the whole thing that's going to produce one droplet here, or one droplet there, or a system which will produce two droplets. Two droplets are in different positions, but when they are enfolded, they're all mixed up. The ordinary description in physics says that all points are entirely outside of each other and have, like, only contiguous relation, i.e. only relations can be proximate, close to each other in space and time. That's effectively the Cartesian view, stating that apart from the I, that's only me, not you lot, apart from the I and God, only what is materially visible and extended is ultimately real. So denying the existence of the entire sea of energy that underlies the whole thing, effectively, and therein lies the problem. It always makes me chuckle that bit, actually, this idea of only I and God are materially visible and extended are ultimately real, because Monty Python on their Live at Drury Lane had one of their joke quiz programs in which they asked which famous opponent of Cartesian dualism resists the extension of physical phenomena and insists there is no point of connection between the extended and the unextended, which is more or less the subject of this show, really. And the answer in the quiz, in the Monty Python quiz, was Henri Bergson, who, as we've already heard, postulated that the ultimate reality is a vital impulse comprehensible only by intuition. So that's saying exactly the other thing from your Cartesians. It's saying that really it's our intuition, it's our chemical interpenetration of with the system that we're living in. It is only comprehensible by us feeling it, not by thinking about it. In the description of reality, the droplet in the mechanism or of the particle in the quantum experiments exists, and its essence is to be in one place, then another. That is the Cartesian view. But the droplet crossing is only an abstraction, which is manifest to our vision only when gathered to a very dense state at a given moment. The reality is the enfolded order, which is always whole and which is essentially independent of time. So that enfolded order is whole no matter what state the ink droplet is in. And it's interesting also that it only becomes manifest when gathered to a very dense state at any given moment. Because of course, one of the aspects of the world in which we live is that it is described as a dense state, as a heavy state, as that's what it is that's kind of yielding our apparent physical reality. And this very dense state at any given moment, if it wasn't for our homeostatic systems that enable us to hold this vast, seething fountain of energy that is the human being together, are another bunch of little subsystems that make us believe and feel that that is the case. So once again, we have a kind of physiological similarity, if you like, between us and these little ink droplets that Bohm spent so much time playing with. So the Cartesian claim is that the fundamental movement is a localized entity moving from one place to another, the classical view, crossing in space and taking time to do it. Whereas David Bohm claims that the fundamental movement is folding and unfolding. The ink drops are only a model. The hologram itself, in which we're living, is infinitely finer, and there are no ink drops, really. And he does argue, in fact, later on, that even thoughts, especially thoughts, actually, are responsible for getting in our way of actually coming to grips with this implicate order. So even the idea of ink drops becomes something of a problem, let alone the ink drops themselves. It's important to realise as well, people get a bit confused, this is not anything to do with the action at a distance, which was, I think, supposed by Newton. He didn't really like it at all, but it was kind of essential to his mechanical theory, and he had to stick with it. It was also denied by Einstein and Descartes, obviously impossible if you believe that everything's physical moving through time, to believe in the action at a distance beyond sort of magnets on an iron filing. Bohm's claim is that the implicate order always deals with the whole, but that the connections of the whole have nothing to do with locality in time and space, but have to do with an entirely different in quality, which is unfoldment. And again, I just really like the idea of dealing with the whole, because it's by encouraging us not to deal with the whole, and to regard certain other parts of what is obviously a whole, to regard them as separate from us and less capable of separate treatment, which is causing so much of our problem. Another challenge that might appear because of the way we consciously receive things and understanding them, it might appear that because one of those droplets has been enfolded a million times and will manifest much later on the rewind than one that's only been enfolded 100 times, that one is further back in time than the other. But the implicate order theory recognizes that we've got to introduce differences or distinctions and orders and relationships to have anything to talk about. The key issue is, what are those differences or distinctions going to be? Are they going to be contiguous relationship in space and time, or are they going to be something else? And Bohm suggests that they are very much something else. All existence is basically hollow movement, which manifests in a relatively stable form. The word manifest itself is based on mani, which means to hold with the hand, or something that can stably be held by the hand, something solid, tangible, and so on. Also visibly stable. The flux arrested, as it were, coming to balance for the time being, a bit like the homeostatic human, coming into relative closure, like the vortex which closes on itself but is always moving. Another great image. I love the pattern of vortex in water because it allows us to see how pattern might exist while substance changes. When you see one of these spinning patterns of water with bubbles and sticks in it in a river, the river's flowing through as normal. It's not the same water in the vortex, but the pattern of the vortex is still there. And it does that thing that John Bide describes, where it is moving faster and faster as it gets to the bottom. It is closing in on itself and, of course, generating a bit of levitational force along the way. So it's a bit like clouds holding a stable form can be regarded as a manifestation of the movement of wind. Basically, clouds do change a bit over time, but they form up there and they move around with the wind. And it is wind and temperature currents from the earth that form them. And just like that, just as clouds can be regarded as a manifestation of the movement of wind, so matter can be regarded as forming clouds within Bohm's hollow movement. And they manifest the hollow movement to our sense and thought in much the way that clouds manifest the movement of wind and current to our sense and thought. These are comparable ideas. Bohm spends a lot of time highlighting a fundamental confusion that kind of lies at the heart of quantum mechanical theory. And this fundamental confusion is one of the reasons that he's put his theory forward. It is endeavouring to address the dire situation we find ourselves in as a result of the situation he describes. It's one that, again, that we're pretty familiar with here because I know I've heard Freeman Jack talking about it. We've heard Lipton, Sheldrake, many other people saying that mechanistic science has some fundamental problems, and here's Bohm describing them to a T. Fantastic. He says the base mathematical description of movement in quantum mechanics is exactly what we're talking about. It is just simply the mathematical description of the hollow movement, the movement of the whole. And it's also, of course, a mathematical description of the performance of the brain. But at present in quantum mechanics, there is no physical notion of what movement means. So we merely use the mathematics to calculate results, saying that those results have no meaning whatsoever other than that. Physicists do use the idea of fields and particles and so on, but when you press them, they must agree that they have no image whatsoever what these things are, and they have no content other than results of what they can calculate with their equations. Their only anchor is the experimental results. They're saying that these numbers that they get out of their calculations agree with the numbers that come out of their machines. In the old Newtonian view, you suppose that matter was really made of particles or whatever, and you said that the equations enabled you to calculate what these things are going to do. But you didn't in those days say that there's nothing but equations and measuring instruments, and that the equations enable you to do nothing but calculate the numbers that are going to come out on your measuring instruments. Reality, Bohm says, is based on the word res, meaning thing. And the thing is what is known. You see, the word res is based on the word rere, meaning to think. And the thing is what you think about, essentially. So reality is just what man can know. Now, essentially what contemporary physicists are saying, although it doesn't make any sense, is that man's reality is confined to the results of some operations of scientific instruments, but but they wouldn't really seriously argue for that either. And this is where the kind of confusion is arising and inopportuneness and ineffectiveness. He says that on Sunday, when they're feeling philosophical, they say that man's reality is confined to the result of scientific instruments. And on weekdays, they say it's really made of hard, solid little particles, which they know can't be so, because these particles have all the properties of waves, as well as many properties that particles could never have. Then they say it's a truth about these hard little particles, which the equations deny could exist. And then we finally say, let's give up those questions because we just can't answer them and there's no point to them. They are not looking at ideas as material processes. They're saying that ideas are either figments of the imagination or they are truth and reality itself. Then they say those ideas which are figments, they discard, and those which are truth and reality, they say, that's it. That's the way the world is. On the one hand, they're giving ideas no significance whatsoever, and on the other hand, they jump to giving them supreme significance. I think you could say the situation in physics today is thoroughly confused. And actually, Bohm in his writings goes into that in some detail, as does Sheldrake, but I think that's a very tidy description. And these kind of inconsistencies in physics are really quite serious on shall we say, less disputed levels as well, because there are substantial inconsistencies between the various basic physical theories, the ones that endeavour to account for the characteristics of the very small, the large and the super large. Each of these, as far as we can gather, each of these different things kind of yields results that are consistent at their own scale of operation, but frequently and perhaps always inconsistent with the experimental results of the other two. So we are a very, very long way on that basis of having any kind of theory of anything. And as we say, it's making so many things seem like they're not part of nature that we haven't even got means of investigating them or describing them. As it happens, quantum mechanics, just as it can be mapped partially onto the brain, it can also be mapped onto David Bohm's implicate order, which was the work that Basil Hiley was doing for him. If you imagine the picture of ink droplets converging to form a particle, the particles are actually all over the place. If you were to put obstacles in the way of these ink droplets, or indeed the particles, in the way, if you put obstacles in the way of the particle or the ink drops, droplets, they would converge differently, like a wave. It would begin to show a wave-like property and so on. So you see that all the properties of the particle are in the whole order. They're not what we call a single particle. Thus, we can begin to see a kind of reality which would make comprehensible the whole behaviour of this system that we find ourselves in. And Pribram's theory and the mass of clinical data to date suggest that this is exactly the condition of memory. Even the recall of simple items involves like energetic ripples right across the brain. And according to Bohm, memory, and of course memory includes all the conditioning, all the learning, all the assumptions that memory implies, is the primary mode of operation of mind when it is not free of thought, when it is not operating through direct insight. Most of what we're experiencing is a concatenation of memory being applied to the present moment rather than a genuine experience of the present moment as a result of insight. The present state of theoretical physics effectively implies that emptier space has all this energy, piles of energy, an unbelievable amount, in fact, according to recent work, and that matter, this whole world that we regard as the only important thing, is just like a small ripple on this tremendous ocean of energy. It's got some relative stability and is manifest, but it is just a tiny ripple on this huge ocean, in much the same way as the ripples on the pond cast by the perfect pebble are merely ripples on the surface. The pond itself is laminate. It means that it's got different physical structures as you go to different depths and temperatures, and so your perfect pebble as it falls through the perfect pond will make distinctly different impressions as it travels down through the water. But the only bit we see is the ripple on the surface, and the only bit we see on the surface of this entire system is matter itself. The vast majority of the rest of it is energy. The implicate order implies a reality immensely beyond what we call matter. Matter itself is effectively merely a ripple in the background. And the instruments that the scientists are using don't directly respond to this background because they're floating in it in much the same way as a fish is floating in the ocean and is probably not really aware of it. And because their instruments are floating in this background and because they're not capable of measuring it, physicists subtract this infinity off and simply say it's not there. They feel a tremendous pressure, Bohm says, never to consider such ideas, whereas in fact such ideas would be the obvious thing to consider had it not been for this philosophy which says that we should never consider such things. It takes, as he says, several years and a lot of skill to train people to be able to avoid the philosophical implications of their study. We have a word for that, don't we, folks? It's called compartmentalization. The ability to enable people to avoid the consequences or implications of what they're doing. In fact, we face this exactly with the condition of the no-fit state every day. There are many things in everyday life, as we know, that are not as they appear. This is now quite obviously the case. It's taken a lot of skill and time to ensure that people avoid examining the implications of the destruction, robbery and rapine which they witness all around them all of the time. Again, I was struck by that similarity between Bohm's description of his science and my feeling about the world as I experience it. The ordinary physicist, he points out, cares nothing about what is predictable and controllable by any means whatsoever. Oh, well, the ordinary physicist cares about nothing but what is predictable and controllable by any means whatsoever, whether by deterministic methods, statistical methods, or doing yoga, or standing on its head, if that would help. Once again, another statement that I think applies to the no-fit state and the wider world. It seems to care about nothing but what is predictable and controllable by any means whatsoever. If you are not predictable and controllable, we know that you tend to attract a bit of attention, which its main intention is to convince you to become predictable and controllable. So that certainly seems to be true to me of current social management techniques, if that's what we can call them. But the implications of the new theory are as wide as those of the old one are effectively narrowed by the levels of confusion in them. Consciousness is confused by all of this. Confusion is non-clarity. Confusion means melting together. Things that are different are seen as one, and things that are one are seen as broken up into many. So confusion clearly causes chaos. And again, things that are different are seen as one, and things that are one are seen as broken up into many. That is a standard mode of observation, standard mode of perception, it seems to me, that has been conditioned into us. We don't know when we're looking at one thing, when we're looking at another, and quite often when we're looking at several things. Bohm says, let me propose that consciousness itself is in the implicate order, as matter is. And therefore, it's not that consciousness is one thing and matter is another, but rather, consciousness is a material process. And consciousness is itself in the implicate order with everything else, as is all matter. And consciousness manifests in some explicate order, as does matter in general. We might say that matter unfolds from this implicate, hidden, energetic order into the space and time of the real world, and consciousness manifests in the explicate order of the brain. Consciousness is possibly a more subtle form of matter and movement, a more subtle aspect of the hollow movement. So, if you like, as food is kind of grossly needed for our sustenance, and we also need light and air, which are much, much more subtle forms of sustaining nutritive, supporting intake of energy. So he's suggesting that that consciousness is maybe more subtle, bit more like the breath than like food. but it is still essentially a material process, which of course is has not even really been considered, as far as I can tell, by most of the people who've been looking into this. But the source of what we perceive, both of the so-called external world, therefore, and of ourselves, our so-called inner processes, lies in the non-manifest, and the non-manifest itself lies in something infinitely beyond that. Consciousness is not that which is, it comes out of that which is. Another of the confusions that may be arising is that there is some thought, is there not, that all of matter arises as a result of the driving of consciousness, but what Bohm's saying is that consciousness is a material process, and that whatever it is, if we're going to ascribe all of this to something, then it certainly lies well beyond the levels which we're going to be able to talk about by words. Another thing that Bohm is very good at is realizing when he's got to the end of something, when words can no longer do the job, because like the thoughts, they are delimiting ideas. It's very difficult for us to discuss things without limiting them. In fact, as you pointed out, we have to limit them in order to be able to discuss them. But when he says that the manifest lies in something infinitely beyond that, we might think that we've got some kind of grasp on that, but this is where Bohm gets really careful. He says we have to be careful because we've implicitly postulated, suggested, that thought has already gotten down to that which is, grasped it, grokked it, taken it on. In that, you immediately find yourself imagining the deeper thing, which is, and the thought coming out of that. And that, he claims, is our basic self-deception. That is where our problems arrive. Thought cannot grasp that which is, and any attempt to grasp that which is engages us in a series of self-deceptions which confuse us. He says, points out that science can never reveal that which is either, because it's a process, it's always relative. He says that if you were to take the implicate order theory and make it absolute, make it infinitely powerful, versatile, whatever, then this new theory, which is intended to highlight the confusion and give us some means of addressing it, would become like all the other theories. It would, as a result of that unlimited running away with itself, become another source of confusion. So he's suggesting that thought, which so much gets in the way, has to learn or somehow come to a state of discipline where whatever you want to call it, well, spontaneous self-discipline, it's only when thought is not there that it would be possible to perceive what is beyond thought. Cracking sentence from Mr. Bohm there. It's only when thought is not there that it would be possible to perceive what is beyond thought. And therefore, of course, all thought actually stands in the way of that comprehension or apprehension. When thought is there, attempting to capture what's beyond cannot work. Thought has its place, but thought, trying to go beyond its place, blocks what's beyond. And that again appears to be a habit that's pretty well embedded in science. It seems to be necessary that it manifests as proof for specific thoughts rather than proof for the state of the world that it's investigating. Bohm and Krishnamurti claim that what they call insight can pierce through this state of affairs and change matter, actually change the matter of the brain itself. We know that the brain itself does change. We know that that its actual physical expression changes when people are practicing compassionate meditation and the like. This again has been seen using MRI scans. I'm also aware that Hamish Miller, when he did an experiment where he allowed himself, when he was dowsing, to be wired into a computer and let people look at his brain waves and things, and they noticed that he was using wholly different parts of the brain when he tuned in to dowsing than he was using in his everyday life. Insight is like, can occur also in the brain, just arising, as it were, out of the world. We could suppose that there is an insight that may arise in this unknown totality. And this insight acts directly on matter, most likely in the subtle non-manifest, so beyond the one we're talking about, but that then changes the manifest. The brain matter itself can change and be made orderly through insight, because insight clears confusion. Thought itself changes in that case, not by thinking, not by reasoning, but rather by a direct change that takes place in thought. So we're saying that the subtle is basic and the manifest is the result. And the usual way is to say that what is manifest is what is real and what is subtle is rather unimportant. The non-manifest is the subtler, and the subtler has the power to transform the gross, but not vice versa. The suggestion is that insight is intelligence beyond any of the energies that could be defined by a thought. This is one of the things that comes up in the Bible a lot, isn't it? There is a lot of emphasis there on dreams and visions, on what we might call intuition. I gather also that a lot of science, things like the periodic table, and the shape of various molecules have arisen in the minds of experimenters, just arisen, just as an insight, come in a dream, come in a vision, come in whatever form, rather than through progressive thought. Even sometimes, possibly even quite often, it seems that as people are working together with ideas and somebody throws one in and another idea gets thrown in maybe a bit later, and so the thing gets modified, and over time, through the exercises of various people and various minds, becomes a workable idea. But quite often, even under those circumstances, the actual breakthrough comes in the form of an insight, an aha moment. And they're claiming that this active intelligence can directly transform matter. It sort of bypasses thought as of little consequences round the edge of the barrier. The insight, because it is supreme intelligence, is able to arrange the very structural matter of the brain, which underlies thoughts, so as to remove the message that is causing the confusion, leaving the necessary information, and leaving the brain open to perceive reality in a different way. And this is one of the things that mystics, some of them, seem to be able to do, like I say, as a daily practice, really. The difference here is that we're seeing science approach the same conclusion, really. That idea in itself causes some people a fair degree of problem. But at present, intuition is blocked. It's blocked by all of the conditioning that we experience, because it creates a pressure to maintain what is familiar and old, and it makes people frightened to consider anything new. So reality ends up getting limited by the message which has already been deeply impressed on the brain cells from early childhood. Now, the insight actually removes that message, that part of the message which is causing the block. Let's take a physicist. If he's been subjected to all these courses in quantum mechanics and pressures to think in this way, he'll be approved of if he does, not if he doesn't, and so on and so on. The minute the idea occurs of thinking another way, there will be an intense pressure after such training and conditioning that will blot it out. So therefore, that isn't reason anymore. It's unreason, which is what a lot of science looks like. And that is true of archaeologists, many scientists, in fact, as I say, right across the scientific piece. A mixture of peer review and being forced to work on other people's research papers for many years before you can do any of your own work ensures that these pressures are maintained, if you like. In fact, you don't get the jobs, do you? Let's face it, you don't get the jobs if you don't come up with the right conclusions, and you are very likely to lose your job if you come up with unfashionable conclusions, and as has been shown many times over, your laboratory is likely to be raided, your material removed and destroyed, or at least arranged, have it arranged so that you can no longer have access to it. So, it is true. This is, again, something that Bohm is describing, which really, and again, Sheldrake goes into it as well, it does seem to be epidemic, really. It's right across scientism. But Bohm's hoping that the implicate order helps remove some of these barriers to this work, that it offers something of a solution. See, if we accept the idea of the explicate order of everything outside everything else, everything manifest, then it seems absurd to think of human beings all becoming one and so on, of the universe as a single whole. But now we say that the earlier view itself, i.e. the explicate order, as the ultimate or whole of reality, was a tremendous abstraction. It has to be, because it's a thought, it's a construct. So that in itself is an abstraction. It's really very coarse and gross. And that by following science itself, we've been led to a view which is compatible with the wholeness of mankind, or its holiness, which of course should have a W on the beginning of it, if you want it called that. Mankind is now splintered and fragmented into countless bits, not only nations and religions and groups, but each individual in families, isolated from each other, and within each individual even, many fragments. And this tremendous fragmentation gives rise to chaos, violence, destruction, and really at this stage very little hope of any real order ever coming about. And now all of this chaos, violence and destruction is supported by the general view of everything. You know, that the basic reality consists of little bits, all outside of each other. This Bohm is saying that it is this fragmentation. It is, and we are aware that to a great extent that is a dynamic. Once we are convinced to see something of the one as the other, it appears then to be pretty easy to condition us either to have a go at it or not to care if some other aspect of our society is having a go at the thing that is regarded as separate. And it used to be blacks and homosexuals and all manner of other people, but now it's smokers, it's people who swear in public, it's people who drop litter, it's all manner of people. This splitting up, this moving apart that is causing, according to Bohm, all the chaos, violence, destruction, is still happening. We're still being fragmented, still being pushed aside. And his argument is that if we can start coming together again, we might see some progress. The true state of affairs in the material world, as far as Bohm is concerned, is wholeness. If we are fragmented, we can only blame it on ourselves. And by saying that, he is really kind of moving responsibility for this change to ourselves. We stand at the center of our experience, orchestrating every single move. And if we are fragmented, if we are involved in destructive and chaotic activities, then there is only ourselves to blame. Of course, one of the things that we have been taught to do is look outside ourselves for someone to blame, just as the same as we've been taught to look outside ourselves for somebody to lead, if you like. And in fact, the outside and the inside, it is suggested, are the same thing. In the non-manifest order, all is one. In ordinary matter, this is so, and it's equally so, or even more so, for this subtle matter, which is consciousness. Therefore, if we are separate, it's because we're sticking largely to the manifest world as the basic reality, where the whole point of the manifest world is to have separate units, or, well, relatively so anyway, separate but interacting, and so on. So the actual problem is there embedded in the very reality that we find ourselves in. The problem is the separateness, and the separateness is the entire purpose of the manifest world. We are here to give ourselves the experience of separateness as a change from oneness. Hopefully, it's become clear during the course of this that in terms of ideas alone, there are many correlates with what we as individuals are recognizing through our own experience. But Bohm asserts that the potential for personal change extends well beyond this. In an interview from the Revision Journal, from which a lot of this particular bit of the show has been taken, Weber asks Bohm, he says, if one were really to take this seriously in one's daily life, how differently would one interact with another human being? Well, clearly, just for a start off, it makes a lot of difference if you recognize that the other human being is one with you rather than something entirely separate, and that in a very real sense, if you're kicking that other person, you are kicking yourself in ways that we don't have to go, can't go into at the moment, but that definitely seems to be the case. Bohm answers that question by saying, well, it would be a tremendous change, but you see, to do this, we have to get clear of the recording in the brain of this other view, which has been deeply recorded in the material structure of the brain. We could call that the corruption of mankind, that the brain and the consciousness and the deeper levels, not only in the manifest levels of the brain, but also in the non-manifest, that there has been left this pollution, which is this whole view that leads to violence, corruption, disorder, and self-deception. See, you could say that all of mankind's thought is aimed at self-deception. And that self-deception momentarily relieves pressures that themselves arise from this way of thinking, of being separate. And that produces pressures. And when a person is under pressure, any thought that comes in to relieve that pressure will be accepted as true. But immediately that leads to some more pressure because it's wrong. And then you take another thought to relieve that thought. So these are the kind of feedback systems that lead to this kind of ever building up of more and more confusion. It's, Bohm says, pressure that's arising entirely from self-deception. And again, I took that one quite personally. I know that in times when I'm not dealing with things and convincing myself that I can get away with not dealing with them, it does lead to a lot of internal pressure. It leads to pressure from the outside to a certain extent, but mostly it's generated from within, and mostly it's completely imaginary. As things turn out, stuff mostly seems to work out all right. And this idea that when a person's under pressure, any thought that comes in to relieve that pressure will be accepted as true. Well, I recognize that that may well not be true for absolutely everybody, but it's certainly true for me to a certain extent, in recent times when there appear to have been causes to raise panic and fear and lots of other things which were imperfectly understood. Almost anything that's offered as a solution does give a temporary respite, if you like, from the pressure. Fairly quickly, though, if the thought is incorrect, unsuitable, unmanageable, uninterpretable or unimplementable, then very quickly one moves back to the pressure, and obviously in time things have moved on a little bit and the pressure might well be a little bit more. We observe the chaos that results in this in our daily life and in the large scale as well in human relationships. We see that chaos is the pervasive factor and order is only relative and limited and occasional. And we see that the origin of that chaos is in our thought, in our fragmented, atomistic thought. Yes, well, enough said on that, I think. And Bohm's solution is to suggest that we have to bring about order in this limited field of thought, because that is the source of the disorder that prevents the larger field from operating. And I think a lot of us have been forced to think in a very different fashion since we started getting ourselves involved with the new dictionaries and having a look at the way words are being, words and things are being operated upon. And that is another field that has, of course, completely run out of control, and needs to be clarified. There needs to be a degree of insight there in certain places such that it can sort itself out. But one of the things I like about this idea of bringing about order in the limited field of thought, because it is the source of the disorder that prevents the larger field from operating, is the phrase that he uses. As I've said before, I am a great believer that global and cosmic ascension is possible. I don't think we're going to go over there with the vacuum cleaners and tidy up all of the physical mess we've made here, but I do believe that it's possible that our minds and the world will change around us. And this idea that simply addressing our own thought patterns can enable this larger field, the more subtle field that's around us, to operate as it was designed to operate rather than in a state of great confusion is a great thought, especially at the moment when things cosmically and on earth and within us are changing so quickly anyway. And as Krishnamurti points out, this business of bringing about order in this limited field is a matter. It's one of those famous things, isn't it, that every journey begins with a single step. As Krishnamurti points out, we begin on certain simple things. We don't waste energy on, let's say, drinking and smoking and quarrelling. Well, I agree with the quarrelling. Might take a bit to get around to the drinking and smoking. But these things drains. They're very destructive, especially the quarrelling, which seems to me is deeply encouraged by also all manner of unlikely means. When you watch the pressures that make a quarrel, you're already required then to look inwardly at what's driving you into this irrational and destructive behaviour. Ideally, anyway, it seems that a lot of quarrels are habitual. But you go in from this kind of inward looking, if you like, to find out what's driving you forward. you go on from there, and it's only being summed up here. There's quite a lot of interim steps, but you move seamlessly from looking inwards to an insight that's not only into the specific pressure that's causing the argument, or that pressure, another pressure that might have arisen, or the other pressure, but you get an insight into the whole of pressure, into its root. And some of this can come through, like they say, through spectacular insight. But I found that it's more like that sort of recurrent patterns building up over time. In fact, I especially enjoyed this point this time around. The whole text has changed a lot since I looked at it last time. But living life as I have in so many environments over the last year, it's been moving a lot. And that tendency has seriously accelerated markedly during 2012. It's become helpful to have strategies that deal with categories of situation rather than having to deal with each situation anew. It's like going further into the causes of, say, discomposure, or indeed its counterparts or opposites. Going into that quite often seems to reveal basic causes that actually underlie whatever emotional response has been triggered by our environment. And it seems to me anyway that discoveries of these depths, these underlying patterns, can result in a sort of generic strategy which is can turn out to be good for a whole sea of difficulties. It's like one solution for many problems rather than an entirely handcrafted on the spot response to each occurrence. It's often a matter of a principled response. Obviously each one's unique due to circumstance, but like the resonance or the energetic approach has been practiced and more generally applied. And so I really liked insight into the whole of pressure, into its root, because it's a kind of de-distraction, if you like. It's a concentration of energy, and it does tend to make things a lot more peaceful and quiet. Bohm reckons that these pressures probably originate in the non-manifest consciousness, and then it kind of manifests, just unfolds in front of us. And as it manifests, it comes back in to pollute the non-manifest conscious further. So again, we get one of these feedback loops where the first time it arises, it falls back, which pollutes the place that it came from, so the next arising is polluted. And once again, we're well aware of this kind of ratchet practice in all manner of applications in everyday life. So the stuff kind of piles up. So we could say that all pressure effectively has one germ, and the germ of all the pressure is all of the confusion that we find ourselves experiencing. And the insight into that germ will remove that germ and allow the whole thing to clear up. So the thing is that this is a business of the thing that's looking at the thing that's being looked at. This is just like we can build the stuff up by polluting the non-manifest so that it repollutes the manifest. The argument is that by gradually unpolluting the manifest, that will feed back into the non-manifest. And so slowly but surely things will start to clear up. Maybe not that slowly, in fact. Because when it clears up, even as you start to clear it up, energy starts to rise and build up. And energy has been called passion. And as Bohm says, at this stage of the game, it is clarity and passion that together are most needed. And boy, there you go, there's another thing. How many of you out there feel that clarity and passion are actually the kind of the main things we need in dealing with the things that we're dealing with? And the whole corruption of the non-manifest, the pollution which has accumulated over the ages, we could call the sorrow of mankind. It is not just in the individual, it is in the non-manifest consciousness of the whole of our race, in the whole of man, humankind, whatever, man and womankind, whatever we want to call it. And the sorrow itself creates this immense pressure to relieve it. And that pressure to relieve it further corrupts and pollutes everything. It's, to a certain extent, the argument might suggest that if one saintly entity were finally to achieve this kind of realization, that the transformation of everything would then follow as a matter of course. But Bohm says it's kind of like a matter of critical mass or process. It's something like the transformation of the atom, because in the early days they transformed just a few atoms, and he says we could call that the transformation of the atom in germ. But then it spread like a flame, and it became a power, and then it became a chain reaction. And the individuals who see the kind of principles that we're talking about here, the principle about the importance of inner energy and intelligence, may be like the one who's discovered the transformation of the atom. In principle, he's already transformed mankind, but it hasn't yet come about. His effort is effectively outweighed by the massive pollution that's gone on over the ages, but this pollution can be burnt up. It's been burnt up for that individual. It's probably been burnt up maybe for people like Tony Parsons and David Kass. The point is, we need a still more intense energy than the individual can give. And what Bohm proposes is that it's possible now for a number of individuals who are in close relation and can trust each other to establish a one mind for like the whole set of individuals. In other words, that their consciousness is acting as one. If you had as many as 10 people or 100 people who could really be that way, they would have a power immensely beyond the individual person. And Bohm thinks that that would begin to ignite, really, the whole consciousness of mankind. We've seen that even one man like Hitler, who had a great passion, great energy, had a tremendous effect, although for destruction. If there'd been 10 people, Bohm figures, with Hitler's passion all working together, nobody could have resisted them. Myself, I imagine that many such groups are already working. I'll see the evidence of it. Obviously, many are working for the shadow, but many more are working for the light as time goes by. I think, again, that's something that we can all see happening. What Bohm is saying is that taking this view, that consciousness deep down is one, that the whole of mankind is one, is important. But he says any part of mankind may establish a oneness within that part of consciousness. And if 10 people can give their part of consciousness all one, that is an energy that begins to spread into the whole. That again is something, of course, that is touched on by Rupert Sheldrake, this idea that as each of us chooses, so the world becomes. Every single decision we make, every feeling we have, every action we execute is recorded in this morphic field, which helps to define all future actions, reactions, and the like. That we're not only guided from within by our DNA, but also from without by its macrocosmic counterpart, the morphogenetic field. Bohm points out that on this basis, individual salvation actually has very little meaning, because as I've pointed out, the consciousness of mankind is one and not truly divisible. Each person has a kind of responsibility, not, however, in the sense of answerability or guilt, but in the sense that there's nothing else to do, really, you see. There's no other way out. That is absolutely what must be done, and nothing else can work. And that, of course, is what the mystics have been saying for ages, and the people who do meditation, and the people who've spontaneously awoken to being part of the cosmic background. They've said that the thing that's standing in the way of us is thought, and that what we need to be able to do is move beyond thought. And as Bohm says, we can't move beyond thought by thinking.